From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a Week in Review, looking at Arkansas news, politics, and more. Coming up,
floodwaters should finally begin receding along two rivers in central and south Arkansas, but it will be a long recovery. We'll have an update.
It was described as looking like a geyser, a natural gas pipeline running through the Arkansas River ruptured. The cause is unknown. We'll talk about what we do know.
A Republican state lawmaker leaves his party to become an independent, while another party decides not to field candidates in 2016, and another is in.
The newly created Jacksonville North Pulaski County School District is taking steps to prepare to go it alone.
And midway through a nearly $70 million renovation of Little Rock's historic Robinson Auditorium, we tour the facility and update on the progress ahead.
I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
That's all just ahead from KUAR News. The images of flooding along the Arkansas River in central Arkansas and the Red River in southwest Arkansas have been striking, especially in Pine Bluff, where hundreds of homes have standing water inside them. That water should finally now be receding, but Chris, it will be a slow process, and what's left won't be pretty.
Yeah, that's right. About half of Arkansas's 75 counties have been declared disaster areas, which will allow the residents in those areas to seek state assistance at some point if they need it. A lot of people have been evacuating from their homes, some voluntary. But the Arkansas Department of Emergency Management recently issued a mandatory evacuation for the town of Garland City. It's a few miles east of Texarkana. There, about 240 residents were asked to evacuate after officials there determined a part of the levee had a weak area kind of in a pond. I spoke with an Arkansas Department of Emergency Management official earlier. He said that basically there's a weak area near the levee kind of in a pond on the dry side of the land, and they took it as a precautionary measure. It was the first actual mandatory evacuation of anywhere along the Red River, even though flooding had occurred in several areas. And he says that the evacuation order will likely last a few days. His name is Rick Fair. He gave a kind of an overview of the situation over the last few weeks.
We've just not had any ability over the last 6 weeks to let this water go downstream without replacing it with more. It's just, it seems like every other day there was another 2 inches of rain falling. And when you put rain on top of ground that's already saturated, it's just going to run off. And that's why we've had as many flash flood warnings and flood warnings as we've had. Now, even though it seems like we're in a little bit of a drier period now, that doesn't mean that the threat's passed, because there are a number of lakes to the north of us and to the west of us that are just absolutely full, and they've got to let some of that water go, and it's going to flow down this direction too. So the Red River is most likely going to remain at flood stage, right around flood stage, for another month.
And though the Red River has reached a cresting point this week, of course those concerns remain. And Fair also said that while many of the counties in the state, including Miller County, where Garland City is located, the city was evacuated, have been declared emergency or disaster areas, there is a possibility that there could be a federal declaration as well.
If there comes a federal declaration of a disaster in the state, and that has not happened yet, but it could, then there will be some help coming from the federal government. FEMA will step in, and there will be some other help, perhaps in terms of low interest loans, things of that sort. So the process of assessing damage has begun. It will continue for some time, and the recovery process will certainly not happen overnight. But as we go along, there are likely to be several different layers of help available.
Yeah, so we'll continue to see what happens in this area, whether or not residents will be able to return to their homes, and emergency officials will be assessing the damage.
Yeah, and here in central Arkansas, it's really been something looking at what the Arkansas River looks like. I was out there on Thursday at just the level of water, the circular piers that are around the bridge supports that define the navigation channel of the Arkansas River. It's been decades since I've seen them that high, almost about ready to overflow, go over those piers. But Sarah, this down in southwest Arkansas, the Red River, this really has been really bad for agriculture in that area.
Yeah, Michael, the Red River and the Little River area have had about 50% of their crop, mostly hay crop, underwater. About 5,000 cattle have been affected by rising water and flooded fields, and farmers there have been working to move livestock out of the water's path. Arkansas County Extension agent Joe Paul Stewart spoke with our content partners, KTXK in Texarkana.
What we're hearing, it may be 2 to 3 weeks before the water gets off, and if that's true, it'll be 100% loss on them. And we're talking probably 6,000 acres of corn, several thousand acres of soybeans, and then also we've got winter wheat that was ready to be harvested. That's basically all of it's going to be ruined. I'm not sure how many acres that we actually have of it, but right now it's going to be really hard to assess the total damage until the water does get off. But if it stays on it for 2 to 3 weeks, there won't be any of it survive. It just, you know, can't go that long without oxygen. It's going to drown everything out.
And on the Red River, a 24-year-old man remains missing. He and his parents went out in a boat to check on some flooded property, and he fell in the water. And along the Red River, levees are continuing to hold. Larry Pritchett is director of the county's Office of Emergency Management.
We have a few places where the water is seeping under the levees. We have a few sand boils, which is not a problem at this time. We're currently working on one just north of Garland City there, north of Highway 82. The Corps of Engineers is over there taking care of that situation. But other than that, now down south on Miller County 12, there's a pretty significant area covered in water down there. The road is covered up pretty good down there.
Pritchett says he expects the river to crest sometime Friday, and it may be weeks before the waters recede back to normal levels.
I think that's, and what Sarah and Chris have both been pointing to, is that it's not just the Arkansas River, the Red River, but this really is not only an intrastate problem with different rivers and different systems, but it's something that really is affecting Texas and Oklahoma, because all the water that's coming down there ends up in Arkansas. So this really is a regional problem, all of this flooding. And if you look back at the Arkansas River's navigation system, the McClellan Kerr Dam system, this came about in a time of big government with big investments in infrastructure. And you'll see even people who are traditionally small government people, like State Senator Jason Rapert out in Bigelow, he'll say, the Lachlan Dam in Toadsuck in my district is not sufficient to handle these floodwaters, obviously. So it is interesting that it's really part of a nationwide issue that keeps coming up again and again, whether it's highways or what have you. It's really an infrastructure issue as much as it is a weather issue at this point.
And officials have been having to carefully gauge whether or not to release water. In a lot of areas where you do have the dams, officials have been really struggling about how much water to release, but often don't really have a choice in how much to release to relieve pressure in some areas, knowing it will cause flooding downstream, but having to make those tough calls. Well, another issue this week, and whether or not it's related to the flooding is still unclear. But, Sarah, we had the rupture of a natural gas pipeline along the Arkansas River. It was described as looking like a geyser. This was in an area just south of the Clinton Presidential Library. It appears on Sunday morning. Some people who live in that area, who lived in tall buildings, say they heard what sounded perhaps like a jet passing overhead, and looked outside and saw water just being sprayed up from the Arkansas River. And they weren't sure what initially happened, but Sarah, it appears that this pipeline carrying natural gas ruptured at that point.
Right. There's a cross-state pipeline owned by Spectra Energy Corporation, and it was an inactive portion of the line. It had been blocked on either side, but there was some residual gas in that section that was released when it ruptured. About 3,900,000 cubic feet of gas was released and dissipated into the air. A towboat was damaged at that time, but there were no injuries, and the Coast Guard in Memphis has been working with the company to investigate the situation and figure out if the other parts of the line are stable, and they're trying to send divers down to learn more, but the floodwaters aren't permitting that work. So there's really a lack of knowledge all around about why this happened. The company says that in 2012, they inspected the line for corrosion and mechanical damage, and that they don't know why it ruptured. Creighton Welch with Spectra Energy said that in 2012, they inspected the line, that they've done maintenance, and they're not clear on why this could have happened.
We inspected this with what's called an inline inspection tool, where we send a high-tech piece of equipment through the pipeline that takes a number of different measurements to assess the integrity of the pipe and see if there is any damage. And that was, we last conducted that in 2012, and it indicated no issues that would require repair.
He says the situation is under control, that they've shut down a two-mile stretch of the river as a restricted zone, and the pipeline itself is entirely shut down until they determine more about this incident. I spoke also with Glenn Hooks of the Sierra Club of Arkansas, and he said that this is just yet another pipeline rupture in a series of problems with our fossil fuel-based energy infrastructure that continually fails. And while officials at various state agencies and company representatives are saying this is probably related to flooding, Glenn Hooks is of the position that it's a systemic problem with the dangers of fossil fuels, and he'd like to see the state move in a radical direction towards reliance on different forms of energy.
I think that what we're seeing is that pipeline ruptures in Arkansas and across the country are becoming more and more commonplace. And at the same time, we are considering adding new pipelines across Arkansas. I think these accidents really give us pause and make us look closely at these new projects that are proposed for Arkansas. They cross several sensitive and important waterways. And I think the question really is do we want to risk more damage to Arkansas from these pipelines to our environmental health and to our public health, especially for pipelines that are giving us no benefit as a state? Ideally, the Sierra Club is looking for a way to get the nation off of fossil fuels. If they really are damaging from the moment they're mined to the time they're transported in these pipelines, and then the damage they cause when they're burned. We're looking for cleaner energy sources. I think this accident this week is showing us yet again that pipelines are inherently dangerous, and we need to move in a different direction.
Well, it's ironic. Last week on the podcast, we were talking about how the safety of pipelines, and we referenced concerns from Central Arkansas Water about the ExxonMobil Pegasus pipeline. That, of course, was carrying raw heavy crude oil. This was natural gas, so it dissipated. We didn't have a big scene like we had in Mayflower more than 2 years ago, but still raising concerns from people like Lynn Hooks just about the safety of any kind of pipelines and how they're maintained.
Yeah, it is interesting. It's a different type of hazardous chemical that was released into the waterway, into the atmosphere in central Arkansas. But just last week, ExxonMobil, there's some plans to reopen the pipeline and what they might have to do in order to comply with a federal consent decree that still has to be agreed to. But it brings up a lot of the same questions that came up during the ExxonMobil oil spill in Mayflower in 2013, including the response time, how long it actually takes these companies to know that a pipeline is leaking. It's maybe not quite as sexy for the media to cover because, unlike oil, you can't see the natural gas. It's colorless and odorless, although clearly something happened that caused the water to burst out in that geyser that people saw from downtown. So even though if there's residual gas in an inactive pipeline, that makes you wonder that even when these pipelines are shut down because of their age or because something more relevant happened in that company, there's still that hazardous chemical in the pipeline.
Well, Jacob, on to a political story you covered this week. We had a state lawmaker, Nate Bell of Mena in West Arkansas. He changed his party affiliation, went from being a Republican to an independent. Talk a little about what he said about this change. What led him to do this?
Sure. And this is a change that wasn't made with much fanfare. Nate Bell didn't have a press conference in the Capitol steps or in downtown Mena saying, I'm abandoning the Republican Party and becoming independent. This is something that was just discovered because there are some rumors about this for about a week or so before it happened. But the only announcement of any kind came on the Arkansas legislature's website. It simply changed the R next to his name to an I. So that was one of the big things that people first heard about it. But this all came back to last week. There's a big debate over moving the primary election in Arkansas from late May to early March. And Nate Bell was in a committee, a House committee. He was the chairman of it. And he pulled out a lot of parliamentary procedure rules, and he really wanted to stop the advancement of this bill. His explanation to reporters was pretty brief. I'll read it to you. It won't take any time. He said, I believe I can best represent my district and my values as an independent. So he didn't give a lot of detail to reporters, at least, about why, but it did come immediately after this primary vote. But he did take to Twitter, and he took to Twitter today, in fact, in the last 30 minutes or so, and he said, do what the Arkansas GOP demands, or, quote, you will never get another dime from the party. And he says that's a direct quote from someone in the House caucus, although he won't name names as to who, but it's probably someone who might control the dimes in the party. And also on Twitter, he compared various county committees in the GOP, comparing him to Cook County in Chicago, which people often think of as a particularly corrupt place in American politics. He referred to people as, quote, party bosses. He said that this bill is really about Huckabee and me, and he jokes about the primary bill, calling it the Incumbency Protection Act of 2015. And so there's a lot of frustration with Nate Bell. He's always been kind of a wild card with an independent streak. But basically, he thinks that primary move was all about protecting incumbents, and the Republican Party didn't really care about democracy as an institution itself. It was really just about protecting incumbents by making the campaign season twice as long about.
Talk a little bit about Nate Bell's politics, though. He safe to describe him as extremely conservative.
I would say so, particularly on a lot of issues. He first came into some infamy or some fame as opposed to the other 135 state legislators after the Boston bombing marathon. He once again took to Twitter, and he said something to the effect of residents in Boston wouldn't be cowering in their homes if they only had assault rifles. So he's been pretty vocal guy. He's not afraid to say something that might cause some controversy. But if you talk to the GOP leaders about this, they're not greatly upset about Nate Bell leaving the party. They've told reporters, well, we know he votes Republican, and we think he's going to vote the same, which is generally in line with us.
His positions are slightly complicated by the fact that he's voted for ethics reforms, and he also supported the bill that would have separated Martin Luther King Day and Robert E. Lee Day, which Arkansas celebrates, is one of three states that celebrates both on the same day as a state holiday. So he's not entirely, he doesn't have a history of strictly following his party line or being a very conventional thinker.
Right. He's certainly not afraid to step outside of what party bosses, as he would describe them, want for him to do. But in general, he's one of the more conservative members of the legislature. But in terms of things like special elections and ethics reform, he does depart significantly sometimes.
And this doesn't do anything really to the balance of power. Republicans still have a very strong majority in both chambers of the legislature.
Right. As we saw in the special session, they have no problem at this point, it seems, getting those bills passed, despite Nate Bell's objections and despite him being a committee chair and that had a really important say in whether that primary bill advanced. They suspended the rules so his committee couldn't delay it. It probably won't affect the party balance too much in any way, I don't think.
And we should also note that Nate Bell has stated publicly that he does not plan to run for office in 2016. So his recent declarations of party disaffiliation, are probably prompted by the relative freedom that he feels because he's not going to be running for office.
And on the topic of political parties, the Libertarian Party stopped by the Capitol, Jacob, this week to deliver some 15,000 signatures to be recognized as an official party, allowing its candidates to be placed on the 2016 ballot. This seems kind of early. for this midway through 2015 to already be dropping off signatures. Why such an early start?
Right, and this is often the first time we hear about any third party in a given election cycle, and this is looking at 2016. The Libertarian Party of Arkansas, this will be the third consecutive year they've gotten on the ballot to be recognized as an official party. So they would say kind of humorously, this is the third time we're a brand new party in the eyes of the state of Arkansas. And they said that they filed early because third parties typically say that this initial signature threshold in Arkansas to get placed on the ballot is a big burden for them. It costs them about $34,000, which I think if you look at most races, you're going to need to raise more than $34,000 anyway. But they say this initial expense and this initial hurdle is a big deal to get on the ballot for them. And so they hoped if they can get on the ballot a little bit earlier, they've got a few more months to start campaigning in earnest instead of directing their attention and energy to just getting on the ballot.
And meanwhile, the Green Party deciding it won't field any candidates for statewide office next year.
Yeah, and I was a little surprised at this. This is the first time in 10 elections that the Green Party won't be recognized as an official party for the purposes of fielding statewide candidates. Because when you turn all these signatures to be recognized as an official party, that means that any candidate that your party runs will then be placed on the ballot. For instance, Libertarians had 9 candidates on every ballot, at least, in Arkansas in the last go-around. But Mark Swaney used to be the head of the Green Party, at least in terms of the man who's putting most of the energy and effort before it. He stepped down from that role to some degree, and Mark Jenkins is their new state coordinator, and he told me that there's simply a lot of internal party burnout. I think he expressed a little bit of frustration that they haven't had a lot of success. I'm sure we know the Green Party hasn't had too much success, although they have had at some point in the past 10 years 2 state representative who, at least for part of their terms, identified as a Green Party member. But Frank Gilbert, who was the gubernatorial nominee last time around for the Libertarians, he gave kind of a comment that I think encompasses the thoughts of the Libertarian Party and the Green Party, just that they think it's unfair that they have this requirement to get on the ballot every year.
Do you think it's related to money? Money has become more important than ever in politics since the Supreme Court Citizens United ruling. Do you even think it's viable for a third party to compete now in major races against the Republican and Democratic parties?
Well, I'm not going to be the only person in Arkansas predicting the Libertarian Party or Green Party to win any major offices in 2016. But, I mean, it's certainly the money. They can't compete if they have trouble reaching out to 15,000 voters to get on the ballot. Then they're certainly going to have trouble with the rest of their campaigns.
Well, on to education. Sarah, some new developments this week for the Jacksonville North Pulaski School District as it's being created. Talk a little bit about the action there.
Well, the Jacksonville North Pulaski School District separated from the Pulaski County Special School District by popular vote in November, and the two districts are in the process of figuring out the logistics of that separation. As PCSSD Superintendent Jerry Guest told me, this is something that's really never been done in this area before, and they're sort of taking it one step at a time.
The 2015-16 school year will be a critical year in preparation for that standalone date. A lot has to be done. Jacksonville has to create salary schedules and determine what size staff, both certified and classified, who they want to hire. A lot has to be done.
Part of the reason that this was advantageous for both districts is that they're under a desegregation lawsuit dating back to 1989, and there are various areas in which they need to gain unitary status, and Jacksonville would qualify for some state support for building new facilities if it were counted as an independent district. So it's hoping that it could get close to half of the cost of building some new schools from the state by separating from the PCSSD. It's mutually advantageous, although it is a bit complicated, and right now the two districts are sorting out facilities sales, so they're in discussion about a possible $11 million sale of 12 PCSSD schools and a bus lot to the new Jacksonville district. The state's top education official just approved a plan that would leave Jacksonville staff with some uncertainty about whether they're going to be maintaining their positions and whether they're actually going to be making less money than they were under the PCSSD, but starts the process of separating in terms of staffing. And then the Jacksonville district at their monthly board meeting Monday night approved a resolution to propose a budget and tax levy for the 2016-2017 school year that would actually be the same amount that taxpayers are currently paying as a part of the PCSSD.
And that would be decided in a special election later this year.
The 40.7 mils resolution budget will be on the school election September 15th.
All right, well, we'll see what happens. Jacob, we had a story this week, something you reported on almost 2 years ago. And it's worth noting this continues to resurrect itself as one of the top stories on our website, KUAR.org. The headline of that story is open carry legal in Arkansas? Depends on who you ask. This week, that question was brought back up again.
And it still depends on who you ask, it turns out. This law was passed back in 2013, and it came back into popular attention because Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin responded to a Facebook post from a gun advocates group, and he said, "Oh, I think a law passed in 2013 did make open carry of firearms legal in the state." That was followed up by Attorney General Leslie Rutledge, who said, "I agree with that.
I have consistently said over the last 2 years that I interpret Act 746 to mean an individual may carry so long as he or she does so without the intent to unlawfully employ it against another person. Unfortunately, Jacob, we have seen that law enforcement and citizens disagree in the law, and so there is need for clarity. I have had numerous conversations about the need for clarity in this area because we do want to protect citizens' right to carry, but also protect, you know, to ensure that citizens are not in harm's way and they are following the law and working with law enforcement."
And the reason why she says that this clarity needs to be made is because back in 2013, the bill sponsors and people who voted for this bill widely understood it to be, and it was branded in the title of the bill, to be just a technical correction to a law about traveling with your firearms, so that if you were moving from your county of residence to your county of work and you had a weapon with you, that it wouldn't somehow result in a charge of carrying your weapon across county lines or something to that effect. And Dustin McDaniel, the previous attorney general, he interpreted the bill to mean, the law to mean, that open carry is still illegal. So we have a difference in attorney general opinions, and that's played out differently on the ground. We've got sheriffs in Washington County and Benton County telling state representatives, "You can openly carry in our counties. That's fine. We're not going to arrest you." But if you ask the state police, they'll say, "Well, we refer to the last official attorney general opinion, and that was by Dustin McDaniel, which said open carry is illegal in the state." And because Leslie Rutledge, although she said she thinks it should be legal, she just has been making that in comments to reporters, speeches, remarks, but not an official advisory from the advisory opinion from the attorney general's office. And Senator John Woods of Springdale, Northwest Arkansas, who lives in one of those counties where it's legal, he says he really wants Leslie Rutledge's office to come out with something official because he's concerned about constituents in South Arkansas, maybe, or constituents such who might be arrested by the state police, conceivably, for carrying.
Now, I'm thrilled and I'm glad that Leslie feels that way, but we do need something on the books, you know, an official statement from her office. And I personally feel like we do need an open carry bill next session, just because there's just too much confusion, I think.
And that reminded me of something John Woods told me 2 years ago.
I would be more in favor of a follow-up bill next session that just addressed it head-on.
But he didn't do that.
Right, he didn't do that. And the reason he gave is that he said that the current makeup of the Senate Judiciary Committee wasn't favorable toward passing a straightforward open carry bill. And that's one of a rare committee where Democrats hold four of the seats, Republicans hold four of the seats. So he basically said he'd like to clarify it, but he didn't think the votes are there to actually support it in a straightforward manner to legalize open carry. And the second reason, he said that a lot of gun advocates have told him, if you try to clarify this bill, then that's kind of an admission that the current law doesn't fully legalize open carry. So even trying kind of suggests that their current interpretation might be wrong. But let's go back to 2013 one last time and look at Representative Bob Ballinger, another Northwest Arkansas representative who is very pro-gun, very pro-open carry. And this is what he understood he was voting on back in 2013.
I don't know if I knew it before the final vote on the floor of the House, but I knew it before it was who was out and signed by the governor.
So it's kind of interesting. You've got most of the state legislators at the time saying they voted on something that they didn't think necessarily voted for or supported the legalization of open carry. And of course, some senators will say open carry has been legal since the Second Amendment was ratified. So that's kind of where we stand. And I've had two different representatives tell me this week that they were going to send an official request to Leslie Rutledge's office for that official advisory opinion, which is still non-binding. And I checked with the Attorney General's office. They have not received any requests.
So in the meantime, do we expect, at least in these counties where sheriffs believe open carry is legal, we can expect to see people walking around wearing pistols?
That's been the case in a few cities. There's been a gun rights group called Arkansas Carry that's, in the past 2 years, have marched through several cities and done this without any law enforcement harassment or arrests. And there is one case that I think a lot of people are looking at that we'll see more about in Lone Oak County, where a man was arrested for it. So that might end up being the result. We'll figure out what happens in court.
It will be interesting. We're going to wrap up this second edition of our podcast with a look at the renovation of Little Rock's historic Robinson Auditorium, a nearly $70 million project. It's at about the halfway point. So recently I toured the facility, talked with several of those who have been involved, and it's really striking if you go inside there just to see how much has been ripped out of that facility. And I know for anyone that grew up in Central Arkansas likely has some fond memories of going to there. So it was interesting getting a look at this facility and also just looking at what's hoped for this, especially by those with the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra. So here's this is a little bit of a look at the status of this renovation at this point. Everything has been ripped out of Robinson Auditorium, including the stage, balcony, interior walls, and floors, leaving little more than the outside shell of the building and its support beams.
It is really impressive when you walk in to see the volume of this building now, because you can see the floor all the way up to the ceiling. You were never able to see that previously because the performance hall was actually the third, fourth, and fifth levels of the building. Now you can see the entire opening. It really is a massive, beautiful structure.
Gretchen Hall is CEO of the Little Rock Convention and Visitors Bureau and is overseeing the project.
Pretty much everything on the interior has now been demolitioned out, and now we're rebuilding back. So we're putting in new foundations for our future balconies. The stage and the orchestra level that used to be on level 3 of the building have all come out. They're going to drop about 35 feet to the ground level, which was the former exhibition hall level. That will be our new orchestra and stage level.
Scaffolding is now in place inside the building, which is a constant beehive of activity. Paul walked me through as some workers were preparing for the installation of new interior walls. Trucks drove through the building, unloading gravel and other supplies, while heavy equipment was constantly on the move.
So far, we've been really pleased. The structure itself is really great. It's holding up well. Things are moving well, and we're making a lot of progress.
Robinson Auditorium closed last July and is scheduled to reopen in November 2016. So far, Hall says they've had no major unexpected problems and that work is on schedule. The project is funded through a 2% tourism tax that Little Rock voters overwhelmingly approved in December 2013, even though only 6% of registered voters turned out. Some residents criticized the vote, saying the election took place on a Tuesday in December with nothing else on the ballot. Standing outside the building on its west side, the framework of expansions can be seen, including a new lobby facing Broadway and a conference center on what is currently the roof, which will look out over the Arkansas River.
Here you're starting to see the new structure that will form some of the vertical circulation and also the lobby space for our new conference center, so you can see some of the steel beams there. And of course, you can't miss our very large tower crane on this side of the building that was constructed to do all of the heavy lifting for the project.
While campaigning for the renovation, Hall said Robinson Auditorium was outdated as a venue, and many including the conductor of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra, agreed, saying the acoustics were less than desirable. Once work is complete next year, the outside of the iconic building, especially the steps and large pillars, will look familiar, but it will essentially be a brand new performance hall.
This structure means so much to so many people. It's touched so many lives. It's on a very important cornerstone, if you will, of our downtown area. So we're really excited about the restoration from the historical standpoint. But then going inside and being able to gut and provide all of the world-class amenities that you need for a performing arts center, I think it's going to be tremendous for the local economy and the residents here because of the types of events we will be able to bring performance-wise.
That will include touring Broadway productions that in the past couldn't be staged because of loading limitations at Robinson Auditorium. The key challenge now will be constructing the interior so that it provides the best acoustics possible. There have long been complaints about the sound of Robinson Auditorium, especially as it's the home of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra. This is a recording of the ASO there in 2010. Many visitors have identified dead spots, parts of the hall where the audience couldn't properly hear the orchestra or all the instruments. That's why the facility has been gutted and is being rebuilt inside the existing structure. Philip Mann is conductor of the orchestra.
I think one thing that surprises people when I talk about this renovation is the scope and scale of it. For those people that have long-standing memories of attending performances in the Robinson, if you're sitting in that orchestra level right in the middle, that floor doesn't exist anymore. That floor will now be 36 feet below that, almost down on the harp level. And for our intents and purposes, it's a new hall. It's a new space. It's a new home for us. And I'm thrilled for our state and I'm thrilled for our orchestra.
Mann says it's been a collaborative effort with those overseeing the restoration, working with the orchestra, along with acoustical experts, to make sure the design of what's about to be built will provide the best sound possible.
To the city's, and especially the mayor and Gretchen Hall's great credit, they involved me from the very beginning, even to the extent of flying out to New York and meeting with architects and acoustic engineers and things like this. They really have listened to the tenants and what our respective needs are.
Gretchen Hall is CEO of the Little Rock Convention and Visitors Bureau, which manages the auditorium. Standing outside the construction site, she said there are a lot of nuances to consider.
All of the details on the finish work, of course, have an acoustic attribute to them, whether it be wood, whether it be the type of plaster used, the carpeting, everything is a fine detail with how that house will perform for the acoustic.
In particular, they're wanting to make sure the symphony will sound good.
One of the key pieces to providing a great acoustic house is the volume. And so that was really the underlying reason why we dropped that stage all the way down 36 feet. It gave 36 feet of volume and height in that house, and it was really needed in order for that sound to circulate through the house.
The hall, in a way, is, if you think of the end of a trumpet or the shape of a violin, the hall is designed to reflect sound from the stage to the listener. But then there's also the physical proximity that we're excited about, that the seats will be generally closer to stage.
While there are best practices for building an auditorium that sounds good, it's still not an exact science. Mann notes there are plenty of modern, carefully constructed venues that didn't live up to expectations. To allow for tweaking of the sound, he said there will be variable components built into Robinson Auditorium that will be modified to find the best sound.
The new Robinson will have an acoustic tuning period where once the hall is done being built, we still have to tune it. We still have to tweak things here and there. It might mean changing reflective surfaces, adjusting certain coverings on things, whether it's flooring or the positioning of people on stage.
The renovated auditorium will feature a new conference center on top of the structure and a new entrance on Broadway. It will also allow the facility to host productions that it couldn't in the past, thanks to an easier loading entrance. Gretchen Hall is confident Little Rock voters who approved the project won't be disappointed.
It's going to provide a wonderful acoustic experience for the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra that is home here. It's going to be able to attract larger and newer Broadway productions, and we're excited about that. And then, of course, the Conference Center is going to be used for all kinds of meetings, events, and activities, and so that's going to be kind of the new modern face to the grand historic structure on the south side.
The renovated Robinson Auditorium is scheduled to open in November 2016. Michael Hiplin, KUAR News. And with that, that's the end of our second podcast, our KUAR Weekend Review program. Maybe we'll have a name for the program here real soon, but it's been a lot of fun bringing this to you, and if you enjoy it, we hope you'll go to iTunes. We have to have two shows in the can, actually, before we can officially become a podcast by iTunes standards, but you should be able to subscribe to this podcast, and we hope to be back with you next week for another edition. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
And I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
KUAR is a service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Our theme music is by our own Chris Hickey. Thanks for listening.